Hello everyone, I am Jessica Saxton, the Environmental Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and the host of Living Downstream. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Mulala, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer, and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute. Today, we will be talking with Al Walker. He and his wife, Trudy, own 80 acres of land near Idlewild, which was devastated by the Archie Creek fire in September of 2020. Joining us is Casey Hilvick, the Executive Director of Umpqua Watersheds, and I am Jessica Saxton, the Environmental Education Outreach Leader and AmeriCorps member for Umpqua Watersheds. So thank you for joining me today, Al and Casey. So Al, can you please tell us how long you have owned the property and how you found it?
Yeah, it was almost 30 years ago now. And we had been looking for probably about 5 years for a piece of rural property where we could build a home. We were pretty particular, though. We knew we wanted natural water and a good spring or well. And we wanted south-facing slope for solar. We've been thinking solar a long time. And then and a lot of maybe places we had looked at, but hard finding the right place. And then a friend of ours mentioned that this place was up to sale for sale. And she thought it was a beautiful place. And we went up and looked at it, and it was had an old cabin on it, pretty run down. But we thought it had a nice orchard, old orchard, homestead. Found out more a little bit about it. It was a homestead place, and got more information about it and got more excited and eventually bought it.
Was just wondering, tell us about how you two built your first home there and how long that took to plan it and what it was like.
Oh, sure. It was, first thing we did is fixed up the old cabin. It was 4th of July, and I was a member of the Unitarian Church, and so I had a little flyer put out, asked for a roof raising. That was the main thing. We had to get a roof on it because right then the roof was caving in and hurting the rafters, and at least wanted to get the roof on while it was summertime. And some friends came out, Bob Allen and Ken Carlone and a good friend, Larry Flanagan, all of whom have been board members of Watershed. And then Diana DeGroot, who actually was the one that told us about the property. She was formative in River Appreciation Day in Watersheds. So I guess from the beginning, we're Watersheds, who were later members because Watershed wasn't around then, were there helping us. Ken, with his nail belt on, just working really hard on getting that, helped me get the roof tightened up. And we had a nice time. We had a picnic 4th of July, and it was a really fun day.
What year was that, Al?
The year is, my wife could probably, Trudy could probably come up with, I can't remember offhand, but it's about 30 years ago, I figured. 92, I think we bought the place.
So you guys have lived up there a long time.
Well, we didn't, it was so rough. We were just going up for weekends for about a year. And we lived down in Sutherland, and the girls were still in high school. And we said, we wouldn't move up there until the girls were out of high school. And so I asked Trudy what it would take to get her up there. And if she could live with the outhouse, because there's just an outhouse up there. Because as long as I got a hot shower, So then I went to work on a shower house with a propane hot water heater. And eventually when our daughter graduated, we moved up there to the old cabin.
You're so resourceful in your ability to plan things out and build them and, make a dream come true. How did you come up with the ability to do those type of things? It takes a lot of organization and commitment to follow through on something like that and make it happen.
Well, my dad was an engineer, so I got a lot of the building stuff with him. I didn't have a choice when I was a kid. I had to hand him tools whenever there's a project going on, from putting in a half bath upstairs to work cleaning up the garage. He said I was ordered out there to clean up the garage and handing tools when I was fixing cars, and then eventually I had to learn to do some of the minor repairs and things like that. So I guess I had the basic training at home, and then I had a real desire to build a log home. And then in my 30s, I was an executive director, so I guess I got a lot of a school for the handicap, and so work up to opportunity center they called it, and down in Rogue Valley, and that gave me a lot of skills of planning and directing and budgeting and that sort of thing. So I had formal training in a lot of those things, and but then I took a classes in log home building. I went for a long weekend up to Washington. A guy named Skip Ellsworth, he'd built a lot of log homes and really had a nice presentation. He built the log homes up in Alaska. His dad came up with simple techniques to get them built, and it was really a lot of fun. And so then we took on building a log home.
That's wonderful. That was always a goal of mine to.
And actually, I took those classes when I was single. I was divorced and kind of between marriages, and a single dad raised my daughter, I started raising her when she was about 5, and then Trudy came along when she was about 10, and one of the songs I used to sing to Trudy was that I'd build her log cabin someday.
Well, that's wonderful. That's always been a dream of mine to build a log cabin, but I doubt whether it'll happen in my lifetime, maybe the next lifetime. But the fact that you were able to do it and done it in a way that you're totally off the grid, can you tell us just a little bit about what it was like, how you built it off the grid and totally living out
Well,
there?
we just started with the basics. We had kerosene lanterns for the first couple of months, and about that t same time, I kind of upgraded the house to a DC system where there was had a battery system, and I was just charging the batteries basically off driving my truck, so we could at least have a light if we came in late at night or something. It was dark, and just flip an electric light, and Trudy, my daughter had gotten engaged to be married and had a little party for her. And the first time Trudy went to that, she mentioned how excited she was to have a light by the door. And our daughter said, "Oh, Mom, everybody has a light by the door, you know." And she said, "Well, just wait until I get a flush toilet, then we'll really have a party." So, yeah, we were roughing it. And then, so gradually, I just kept adding to it. I put a little, solar array in, and I always wanted to do micro hydro, and we had a nice waterfall and a big fall of water. So that was I've been planning for that for a long time, and we saw where there had been a water wheel there once before for the old cabin, so we knew it was possible. And so I started researching that, and over a period of years, we built a water micro hydro water, it's called, and learned a lot about that. And that was a big support during the winter when we didn't have enough sun for solar.
So you've been a longtime member, supporter, former board member of Umpqua Watersheds. How did you and Trudy get involved with Umpqua Watershed?
Oh, well, it was just osmosis. I never really was on the board, but I've been around board members a long time, and all my friends were going on the board. And at that time, I was just getting involved with steamboaters, and I said, "Well, I've been invited to go on the steamboaters board, and so do you really need me on the watershed board?" And I said, the consensus was, "No, you should go ahead and go with the steamboaters. We need to liaison with them more." So I was kind of a liaison, and Ben was one of the first members of the Watershed Council here locally too, kind of representing the fishermen, but also liaisoning with watersheds. So we'd always been a watershed supporter.
So you're also very active with the Umpqua Valley Brewers Guild and the Umpqua Brewfest. How I first met you was working with the Umpqua Brewfest. Can you tell us a little about that? I think that's an interesting group because of all the different community members that have learned how to brew beer because of the Umpqua Valley Brewers Guild. In fact, we were celebrating my birthday last night at Too Shy Brewing, who got started with because the Umpqua Valley Brewers Guild. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, well, it wasn't until about the time I retired is when I first heard about it. And years ago, when I was in college, actually, I was kind of popular with some of my friends because occasionally I'd brew some beer, and we never got to bottle it. They'd always come and just drink it without even refrigerating it or bottling it. So, but the college kids like to party, but then I made little bottle batches of wine, a few gallons here and there, and so I was fascinated with it. But then I found out about the group, and through Harvest Foods out in Winston, who sold those supplies, found out about the group. So I got involved with them and learned how to do all grain brewing, which I'd never done. I was just done extract brewing. So that was, and it, I really liked the group right away. They kind of have a pledge of not to talk politics or religion, and just talk about beer and sports and outdoor activities. So we went on a lot of camping trips and talk beer and go to the coast and gather clams and oysters and do fun things and mushrooms, a couple of good mushrooming friends, and learned a lot about beer. And Lyle was one of the members, and right away, when I first met him, I'm not sure where he learned, but right away I could tell he was a good brewer, and he gave me lessons on making a good stout because he always had good dark beer.
Thank you. What did you and Trudy do before you guys retired?
Well, I should have a scrapbook of all the things I've done, but basically I guess my highest achievements were working with disabled as an executive director for Rogue Valley Opportunity Center down in the Rogue Valley. And then I went back to college. Well, actually, before I went back to college, I had a frozen yogurt company, one of the first frozen yogurt businesses, and right by the Criterion Theater down in Medford. And then I went back to college and got my master's degree. Oh, I've jumped ahead. Before I went back for my master's degree, I had to go back for my bachelor's. And then I worked for several different companies doing workers' compensation counseling. And that paid pretty good, but I always wanted to be more of a therapist. So I went back for counseling education. I got my master's in counseling. And at the same time, that was when I was working. Oregon was pretty much shut down, hardly any jobs available then. So I ended up moving to New Mexico, living with the Navajo Indians, who had a policy of a day off with pay if you went for further education. And they said, well, we can't discriminate. When I came up with that, in the manual said that's meant for Navajos, but we can't discriminate. So yeah, you can do that. And so was able to get my master's, and they said, but we have favors to ask of you though. So I'd go in on Saturdays and take a group of young men that were the problem makers on the weekends. It was a live-in group home situation, and I would take them fishing in the summertime, or take them hikes, or sometimes during the week we'd go jogging through the local community. It was really, really pretty fun.
Thank you. So it sounds like you got to travel around a bit. How did you end up here in the Umpqua Basin?
Well, actually, I was working on a after I got my master's, Trudy really wanted to come back to Oregon. She was raised here, and so I got a job in I had a job in on the reservation. But then after I graduated, we looked around for jobs, and there was a job that came up in Roseburg, and we said, Roseburg, I'd rather really rather go to Eugene or back to Ashland. And that was my first choices. But said, well, Rose, what we looked at the map, said, well, let's give it a chance. It's close to the ocean, and it's close to the mountains. And we joined the Unitarian Church right away, made a lot of good friends, and settled in.
Thank you. Wonderful.
So, can you tell us a little about the history of the property that you have that you and Trudy now call Dreamcatcher, and its connection to the native people in the area?
Sure. Oh, before I do that, I neglected Trudy's background. She went to school down in New Mexico also. We were both in college at the same time down there, and she got her RN in Gallup, New Mexico. And she has some really nice stories about some Native American ceremonies that were part of her RN. And then she worked at mostly at Mercy Hospital as an RN for her career, did some work for Red Cross and progressive care and home health. She had quite a diverse background in as being an RN. And all the family kind of leans on her when they've got a health problem. What happens? And we couldn't have built it actually without her. I mean, I took some time off from working to build our house, and she supported our family while I did that. So
Well, you two are very much of a dynamo. You complement each other real well, and it's such a force in our community for multiple things, and dear friends of ours. So you're definitely a couple, a power couple, we think, because you work so well together and complement each other. The history of Dreamcatcher.
Oh, okay. Well, and the Native American connections there quite a bit, from living within Navajo for several years, really. And before that, actually, I worked with Indian fishing rights up in Washington, and got to know the Nisqually Indians, and it was wonderful that they finally won their Supreme Court decision on their treaty rights being violated and keeping them from using fishing in their usual and custom places. But so yeah, I've got stories on that. But then the Mace Tipton is kind of a known figure around here, and he was a good friend of the McMillans and of Lavola Bakken, and she wrote about him in a book called The Lone or the North Umpqua Indians, which the museum still prints, and you can buy it at the museum, Douglas County Museum. And she wrote another book called A Lone Rock Free State, in which she mentions Mace Tipton quite a bit too. So he's a real formative figure up there. Because, and I ran into, I've got a little handout that I got, or a little write-up a gentleman did. He was in his 80s and looking around for the Indian graves, and he gave me he had known Mace Tipton and got pony rides from him around 1910 or so, and as a kid was real struck in with Mace. But Mace would I guess was called the last of the Umpqua Indians, and would come to parades and that sort of thing, and he would do educational things with the schools, tell them about Native American traditions, and he was pretty dark complexion, so he looked pretty dark, but he really presented himself well. And he I guess he was raised as a foster child. I've read different things, different places, but I guess the name Tipton came because he was kind of a foster child of the Tiptons, one of the pioneer families up there.
Remember you last weekend when we were visiting you up at your property, you mentioned that when the government came through, I don't remember whether it was a state or federal government, and took the Umpqua Indians off the property that they'd lived on, as part of this wonderful land of the Umpqua, and then forced them in with another tribe on a reservation, and how devastating that was. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, if I can find the quote here, there's a good magazine called the Umpqua Archie Creek Fire, put out by the News Review. It was an insert, but I think you can still buy it through the News Review. They were selling it there for quite a while for a buck or two, but in that it quotes from Lone Rock Free State, where and I just kind of leafed through that the other day. I couldn't find it in there, but there's a quote in here from Lavol Bakken's book that was really well written about that they North Umpqua Indians were always friendly. There were never really any skirmishes with white people or anything like that, but their people wanted their land. People wanted to make room for white settlers to come in, so they were rounded up with other Indians, and they. From what Lavola said, that they pretty much died, most of them died of heartbreak because they were put in with other tribes that they had no, maybe not even a common language with because their language was different. And here's a quote from Lavola. They made the valley ring with the same funeral chant that they made over the dead. It was something terrific, the last howl that the Indians ever made in the Umpqua Valley. And when I got this little book about 10 months after the fire, I started bawling when I saw that. And started bawling again when there was a picture of the grave of Mace Tipton on page 46. And you can kind of see on one of the trees hanging just to the left of the grave marker, you can see a dream catcher. And Trudy had put that year there years ago, and it made it through the fire. And she had put the dream catcher there for the Mace and the other Indians there. He said he wanted to be buried there because a lot of his friends and relatives were buried there also. But his is the only marker there, and that was put on by the Daughters of American Revolution because he had been such a formative person for the Douglas County.
We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Mulala, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement.
I'm proud of the land acknowledgement and this opportunity with the Dreamcatcher Restoration Project is going to enable us to hopefully work with more with the tribal people and tell this story. I think it's fascinating about Alan Trudy's property. It has such a connection to the river and to the valleys, and that and remembering where all that came from is real important.
Yeah, it's interesting that we found out that the driveway going up is was really well made, and they said it was actually the old highway, so it was pretty well engineered, and the way it comes in, and with a there's three tributaries of King Creek, and all of them have nice big culverts underneath them, and you can tell there was a lot of work went into that, and then the Lavola's old cabin was actually here on the site of where her the homestead cabin was, and I guess Mac McMillan, it was a wherever the postmaster was, that w their house was post office, and so that was a post office around 1900 when Mac McMillan was the postmaster, and it's not clear what exactly how long that lasted, for whether it was a few years or 10 years or, but he was also the one that named Idyllwild Park, because he built those cabins down below and changed the name from, it's called Hoagland Post Office at the time. He changed the name to Idyllwild, and he made it hard to spell. So that was kind of his practical joke, advertising thing, and kind of a practical joke. So then people would remember it because it was, how do you spell that
It's still
again?
working today. I always forget how to spell it.
Thank you
But
for
he,
sharing.
sure.
I just want to say I didn't know that Native Americans lived up around Rock Creek or which tribes lived there. I thought I would have known that, being in Glide, living around that area, but I did not know. So thank you for sharing it.
Yeah, you can get that little book at the museum.
So, Al, are there Native people buried on your property?
Not on our property that I know of. This is adjacent property. We've got an easement from Frank Moore Jr. He owns the property right below us, and so that's on his property.
Okay, very interesting.
I've heard different stories, and we've found a few artifacts that we've kind of put back. But so, I mean, there are definitely indications that there are Indians. There are arrowheads and different things here and there, everywhere around up there.
Thank you. So the Archie Creek fire was one of the largest and most devastating fires in the area. How did you find out about the fire and how much time did you guys have to evacuate?
Well, it was we woke up and we could smell the smoke, and then we got a call from our friend who lived down around Whistler's Bend, and they said they were on level two, and they hadn't made any preparations at all, and so I was coaching them for a couple hours actually. They were pretty upset, and trying to get them to round up all the important papers and put them in a car and get out of there as soon as they could, but at least get everything in the car. And everything we heard on the radio and from people reports we got, everything was down below, lower down river, and then all of a sudden we found out of. There was a fire. There were fires above us, and by the time we heard that, Trudy got a call, one of those emergency calls, and we only had about a half hour. I guess it was right on our doorstep. We could see it coming at us, and luckily we'd done some preparation. Of course, you never do enough. We didn't get fo many photographs, but we got our computers, important papers, the dog, and one car and our RV, and we're out of there. And that's what we always said we'd do: we'd be ready, and we. Stuff is stuff, and we'll just get out as soon as we could. And we
That
spent,
had to be terrifying.
yeah, it was really unreal. I mean, it was like I was moving slow time too. I mean, I was moving pretty fast, but it was also mesmerizing and unbelievable. It's like I was in a fantasy of some kind. It was crazy, pretty crazy. Two helicopters going up this big orange ball was right close by, and but they can't go in those flames, and they went right in and drop water, and I got slowed just down and quite a bit there, coming at us so fast.
How did the cable crossing fire impact the response to the Archie Creek fire?
Well, I've talked to a few people that I know in the firefight and said this just moved so fast that they just couldn't do much. It was just moving so fast, and the winds were much different. The winds were coming out of the east and coming down the canyon instead of the Cable Creek was coming out of the north. We could watch it from our front porch, and it was scary. In fact, from that we got a lot more prepared. We were, had made plans and tried to keep a box of insulated file box with our important papers in it. And you know, we should have written down some other steps we said we were going to take. We didn't write it down. So I advise people to write out your emergency response so you can look, because your mind just goes when that emergency hits. So you see your a written list you've got, you can check off your list and get out of there.
We live on North Bank Road, which faces Scat Mountain. We can see Scat Mountain and we can see the fire coming on and we're following it. And we're all just completely devastated when we heard that you and Trudy and the Moores' house had burned. We're so worried about it. We couldn't sleep at night and wondering, well, what's happening? We were just in a state of shock, and we were so relieved the next day to know that you had made it out. It seemed just like a horrible nightmare. How you two been able to deal with such a terrible loss?
With difficulty, but back then I had a counseling background, and she said nursing, you know, I think helped. And we had a lot of friends reached out for us. We stayed for about a week down in Elkton in our RV, and you know, just what it was a week before we even knew if our house was still there. You know, they wouldn't let us back in or anything, so we're just in kind of limbo. And there's smoke was really thick that far away too, down in Elkton. And so we just did the best we could and sat on the couch and held hands and snuggled with a dog, kind of in limbo. But some friends asked us to move in with them. That they had a nice basement that they had developed for their grown grandkids and self-contained. And they took us in for about a month. And then another friend, and they would have let us stay there more, but we didn't want to overstay our welcome. But then we, another friend said she was going to go visit her sister on the East Coast for a month because we house it for her. So we. She was actually the president of the Scrub Brewers Guild at the time, and they're close to where Carlonis lived. So we stayed there a month, and we finally rented a little studio apartment up closer on the North Umpqua, because I was, by then I was starting to work up there. I wanted to work on the property every day, and it was hard, but it's like I felt it was like to me that was an important part of my grieving was to confront it and deal with it every day and get moving, not sit around and ruminate, but try to get moving and get some plans moving and set my priorities. My first priority is making sure my wife and I relationship was good and that my dog was okay because he was in state of shock. And and then the third, number three was the property. And I figure if I take care of the three of them and nurture myself along that'll, you know, we'll all get through this pretty good. And so I started some counseling. And then we did a little everything was pandemics, of course, at the same time too. So, but we got a really good references on a Eugene counselor, and we got Trudy and I did counseling over Zoom with him. He was wonderful and really helped us through it a lot. But it's support from so many different friends and relations, and Bill Black, I guess he's a former watershed member too. We stayed in his little studio apartment, and Bill and Jeannie did all they could to help us out.
You and Trudy, as well as Frank and Jeannie Moore, are such inspirations, all people in our community, because how you dealt with all this with such dignity and open, some people would have retreated inside themselves, and you've always been so open about talking about the experience and what you're going through and honest about your feelings and how hard it was. So that is so important for our community and building resiliency. I know one of the things that you dealt with was dealing with the governmental agencies and the insurance companies after the fire. Can you tell us what you learned through that process?
Even though it's very difficult, study your insurance policy, because if something happens, then you're forced to study it when your mind isn't there. I mean, it was in the state of shock and anxiety and depression that we were in, anxious depression, it's kind of called, and our post-traumatic stress disorder, it's hard to think. And and it was hard to comprehend. Those policies aren't easy to understand. So it took us a long time to understand what they would pay for, what they wouldn't pay for. In some ways, they're really good to us. In some ways, it's been really agonizing. And the agonizing thing is we had to make a complete list of everything we lost and say what a replacement value would be. And that took months to do because it's painful going through and trying to list everything you had and try to put a value on it and, write it down on a spreadsheet. And then it was like, trying to remember everything almost made it worse what you lost. So, but and then getting through all that, and then the agencies wanted to come in and help us, and they did, but sometimes they were pretty heavy-handed. Like they wanted to take everything. Well, first of all, it was like the FEMA was about a year before they came out. So in the meantime, I had done a lot of, I was been told by the people that they didn't recycle any metal. So I found a man that was willing to recycle the metal. So he would come out every day and pick up, and I'd help him get a load of metal. And in the meantime, take photographs of stuff we lost in case we needed for insurance or anything. And he's same age as me. He was 77 and worked like a trooper. And at that time, metal was really expensive. He said he made some good money that year because he helped several people do that. But really nice to get to know him. And in fact, he's one of my main workers now rebuilding the house. He had a house out by ICF block and made it very energy efficient with a ground source heat pump, just like I wanted to do. And I said, "Will you help me?" And he said, "Sure." And so he won't, even though he has retirement income, he doesn't charge me very much, but I pay him. But he's a really good worker and very knowledgeable, and that's helped a lot. But anyway, and I think that helped me going, even though it was a hard slog, that really helped me. And then when FEMA did come, a lot of times they wouldn't announce when they're getting there, and it'd be a real surprise who's coming and what they're going to do. And then they brought big machinery in, and they want to take all the concrete. I said, "No, I don't. You can't take all the concrete out. That's my footing." And the engineer already said that I can rebuild on the same footing. And we had a lot of go-arounds about that stuff. It was pretty emotional for me, but I finally was able to contact some people at the state level who kind of got the word to local people. They had to cool it with me and really negotiate better with me. And we finally got things done pretty much my way. But it took my, I'd had some negotiation and mediation training, and I had to take, one time I asked, even asked a friend to stand by and calm me down if I start getting too excited talking to them. So, because it would be sometimes they were set in their ways about how they wanted to do things. I think I found out they got the contractors got paid by the from ODOT. It was kind of complicated. FEMA gave the money to ODOT, and ODOT had contractors, and the contractors, some of the contractors, I don't know if all of them did, but got paid by the load that they took out of there. So the more they could dig out, the more they got paid, I guess. I don't know if that's true or not. But.
So, as you mentioned before, you guys are not only dealing with this devastating fire, but this also all occurred during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Right.
So, it's amazing how you guys have been able to rebound from all this devastation. Can you share a little bit of what you've learned in the process?
Well, we were able to grasp the concept of pods of people that we knew that were testing and getting their shots and were trying to do the right thing, trying to avoid dangerous situations and taking it seriously. So we had a couple pods of that we socialized with and people that are really supportive of us, and that really helped a lot, to have us like coming back and forth from working up there. My friends wanted me to stop for a beer and stop in for a talk, and whether we had a beer or not, it's just nice to sit and talk with somebody every day. I'd say that's maybe value your friendships, and that and it was so important. And in fact, I lost a couple of friends during this period of time too, who passed away. One from COVID, really good friend, and Larry Flanagan passed away, and I was helping his widow. And then just recently, Lloyd Price, I met through the Brewers Guild, passed away, and I think Watersheds now has his nice drone, and Watersheds will make some good use of drone. But I've been trying to
Yeah.
help this widow out, and but they were all those people were real mentors and good friends, you know, before they passed, and so trying to help their widows and do what I can. And Larry still inspires me. He was a board member and a psychologist, and he was the head of mental health here in the county for quite a while. And then I knew him when he was in private practice, and he shared, we should would share him, go to lunch almost every week. But I hear him looking at a picture he has of eagles. He really liked eagles, and a picture of Sitting Bull and Chief Joseph with a turkey feather. I imagine it would be an eagle feather. And he had a lot of inspiring, a lot of ways he inspired me in my life and helped me. And he taught that just to be grateful and be happy. And so that's why I do try to practice, tell myself that every day is be grateful for friendship and be grateful for the nice times I've had and I continue to have and those nice opportunities I have. And so gratitude and happiness and find ways to be happy.
My wife Janice and I sure appreciate our friendship with you and Trudy. It's always whenever you can take a negative, and this is a horrible negative, you can never make up for it, but you can create positives out of that negative. And one of the things that came about, we connected with you and we went camping, went to Magone Lake in Eastern Oregon, had such a wonderful time with you and Trudy and your dog Tyson and our dogs, Lincoln and Tad, and we consider you both two of our dearest friends, and we're really grateful for that. That even went through this horrible thing, we're so worried about you. To be able to spend time, quality time together, and sit around the campfire and talk about stories, and some of which we talked about in the interview today, making that connection really underscores what you just said, that friendships are so important, and building resiliency and getting through unimaginable loss like you and Trudy have gone through. So we really appreciate that.
Well, thank you,
So,
and thanks for all your support. It's really valuable for us.
well, it's just begun. I'm very proud of Uncle Watersheds and what we've done as part of the Archie Creek fire. We've done a restoration on Rock Creek. We've done restoration on Wright Creek with our programs. Jessica just today was planting willows in downtown, and we've been out cataloging what the aftermath of the Archie Creek fire looks like before they clear cut on private land and on public land, so we can see how it's coming back and what it looked like before, and we can try to understand how to properly restore it. But now we have an opportunity of working on your land with you today, which is February 19th, as well as tomorrow, the 20th, and the next week, the 27th and 28th, Uncle Watersheds and the community will all be out there planting trees, removing invasives, spending time together. Because one of the critical things that happened at Archie Creek, those of us who weren't directly impacted by the fire, had such horrible feelings of what can we do to help? We can't fix this, we can't restore that. But having the opportunity to be on your land, working with you, planting trees, talking about memories you had before the fire, and then building new memories is going to be very, very important for all of us, and building resiliency within our community. Can you tell us a little bit about how you've gone about planning your new place and how are in the process of you and Trudy are in the process of restoring it and building a new home?
Oh, well, I had because I had used solar and was off grid, I got approached early after I'd done some solar work to people were wanting me to teach solar or to be a solar contractor. And I said, no, I'm not going to teach solar, but or I can teach solar, but I'm not going to be a contractor because I like my counseling work. And so I did start the solar tour, and our house was the site of the first solar tour in the county, and we did kept that going for a long time up to COVID, really. And Melanie McKinnon really continued the solar tour after I retired, and she's been great to do that. And hopefully one of these years we'll get it started again. But the so I definitely wanted solar again, but we did as part of the insurance. They brought in electricity for me, so we have line electricity. But I wanted to build a what's called a net zero. When I was doing solar contracting, oh, and I became a solar contractor because they started changing the counseling laws, and I also had kind of a shock of having a retina tear and a good chance I wasn't going to see in my right eye again, and so I started questioning my life, and that was about same time as the Gulf War. And I had to lay face down after every operation. It's kind of like a band-aid to hold the retina in place. And so I was listening to all the news and all the war and everything, and I just go into fits. I said, damn it, it's all about oil. It's about oil, you know. And then the Energy Trust came up with that we're going to train people to do solar work. And I said, well, maybe it's time to change careers. And I couldn't do a lot myself, so it was basically do what I can and then train other people to do the work. And so I was able to train a number of people in solar and actually make some pretty decent money in doing solar and getting it started here in the county. And but so anyway, I wanted to continue that. So I wanted a really energy efficient home because I always and our log home was. It was really energy efficient with passive solar and good insulation. And so I wanted to continue that, but I like the recycled styrofoam blocks idea of because it's R40 walls and goes up reasonably fast, and you don't have to be a super expert to do it. So we're building ICF blocks, and it'll be quite what's called a net zero home, where we will produce as much electricity as we use. And I'm going to be still debating about the cost of heat pumps. I might go with just a ductless heat pump. I really could heat the place easily with a ductless heat pump or two, but I'm also still pricing out the doing a ground source heat pump where you bury loops of piping in the ground and then pump water through it. It's more efficient, less energy, and I could use operate that off solar, and be independent that way, independent heating. But we're also got have an antique wood stove we're going to put in the kitchen, so a kitchen range, and because we enjoyed that, we used to have that in the log house and always enjoyed teaching the grandkids. Now the great grandkids out to cook on a wood stove, and we found a nice antique on Craigslist that's just fantastic that we're excited about getting installed. So Trudy's been our major designer. She's probably shouldn't have been an engineer architect. She's really got the skills, and she's an artist. So I take her lead on design work and finish work, but she lets me have the basically do the basic construction design and engineering type of for structural strength and that sort of thing, and building techniques. So we're a team, and she's more the designer.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We should have brought Trudy into this interview. We got to talking about it a couple weeks ago about doing this, but I didn't know her availability. She has a lot of insight. So what we're going to do is have you back on after we do the Dreamcatcher Restoration Project weekends, this weekend and next weekend. We'll plan another radio interview to do with you both to talk about what we are accomplishing, and you're such interesting people to talk to. So I'm sure she can help us fill up the hour. She's got a lot of insight. So make sure you let her know. Casey said, didn't mean to
Actually,
leave you out.
I invited her. She's very shy, though, so you're going to have to sweet talk her.
Okay, I'll work on that. Another point, Janice and I, our home. You electrified it, solar electrified it, put in the panels and the everything, and so we enjoy solar electricity. And you mentioned Melanie McKinnon, who's also Umpqua Watershed's office manager. She's on the board of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition, and she does great work, as well as Stuart Liebowitz, her friend. and doing that. And we're having an event as part of Earth Day. We'll be at the Aviva facility, where we're bringing in cars, electric cars, and people will have a chance to come in and drive those cars and see what it's like to drive an electric car. So stay tumed for that. We'll have stuff on the Umpqua Watersheds website and a newsletter coming up in March about that. But that fits into exactly what we're talking about, Al. You've been a driving force for solar energy in our community for many years. We just need to turn the notch up and make it available to more people, because it makes a big difference.
Yeah, I always said Melanie was my brain of the solar, because I'd do a brain dump first thing in the morning when she'd come to work, and she'd write everything down in a spreadsheet and start reminding the workers and me about what needed to be done when, and would set up time frames, and she'd really keep us organized. She was really very viable, and so I'm really glad that her career's progressed so well.
Well, she's wonderful. We're so grateful to have her for over the last 5 years at Umpqua Watersheds, and doing the great work that she does for Umpqua Watersheds as our office manager, our grant coordinator, and as just one of our friends that we have that are part of our organization. Just so proud of the work that she's doing. So, where are you at as far as the house goes? I know you've got the first floor done. You're working on the second floor. How long do you think it'll take to get the whole thing completed?
So much depends on weather and money.
Mm-hmm.
We've only got about a little over half of what we need to really finish the house. But my goal was to get it up, get the roof on, get some doors and windows on, and that'll probably eat up most of the money. But then I could keep working away on it, on a little bit of finishing work, or to go on vacation, or both, until we'll see what happens with the lawsuit, because we're suing Pacific Power and part of that lawsuit. And it's looking pretty good that we'll get some kind of a settlement that should give us enough money to finish up without me borrowing, because I don't want to borrow. I've got some money in retirement, but I don't want to borrow against my retirement funds, if that makes sense.
What I always say, it's all about the story. That's one of the reasons why we're doing this interview. We're going to follow up with an article for our newsletter coming up in March to talk about what you all have gone through. Like I've said, it's very inspirational, but it takes a community. So all of us that are going to be part of the Dreamcatcher Restoration Project. It's almost like an old-fashioned barn raising. When something happened in olden times, it'd bring the community together, and everyone would lay a shoulder up and spend the day helping out, building a barn or restoring something that had been destroyed. Where I come from, the Midwest, in a tornado, that's what it needs to happen in our community, and will happen and is happening because of that. That we can come together, do something to make a difference. And when something terrible is happening, and then open up more resources to make sure that you can build your home the way you want it and have the resources and are able to recover from the Archer Creek fire. That's really important for all of us to see that happen. So we're committed to doing everything we can to help.
But that's fantastic. Electric cars. I didn't. One of the improvements we did on the right before COVID hit was to put more solar up and to put 240 power in for the first time off grid, so I could charge my Chevrolet Volt in 4 hours. So it'd be more. So I could operate it more. Otherwise, it took 8 hours and 110. And it was a lot more practical to do it in 4 hours when the sun was out and really strong. So I was really going to it with my Volt, and we escaped with that. I still have the Volt, and we just bought a Bolt, so we'll be coming to that Earth Day event. I used to take my Volt all the time, but now I've got two cars. We'll have the Volt and the Bolt.
Wow. Look forward to seeing it and trying it out. We're in the market for an electric SUV that's built big enough to hold our 2 hour setters. We don't go anywhere without them, and we want a larger range, and now they're improving it. More of those cars. Unfortunately, you have to get on a waiting list, and I was talking to Stuart Leibowitz last week about it. It's hard to get those cars right now. You've got to really work your resources, but hopefully, as we move forward, things will get easier, and we'll see a lot more electric cars on the road.
Right, as demand's there, they'll make them.
You mentioned the drone that you purchased for Umpqua Watersheds, you and Trudy, and donated it to add to our drone fleet. We have three drones that we are have just started using. I just recently got my drone pilot's license, which is required when anytime you use a drone for profit or nonprofit work, you have to go through a 2-hour test and about 700 pages of material. It's pretty intense, but what our goal is to get more people trained to utilize drones for work and restoration and conservation education. And so that's what we're going to do with this wonderful drone that you and Trudy just donated to Umpqua Watersheds. We already have two DJI drones, but they aren't the newest one is an Air 2S that allow us to do a lot of things. The one that Lloyd had is a much more expensive drone. So now we have to update that and have to do some work with what is required. It's called a remote ID. So there's a whole learning curve about that. But what I look forward to doing this weekend and next weekend is teaching you all, everyone, especially you, Al and Trudy, to get out and fly a drone on your around your property and see it from bird's eye view, what it looks like, and capture that. So then, as we move forward with the project, you can go back a year, 2 years, 10 years, and look back at how everything has progressed. And that's a real important part of telling the story. We're doing drone work in areas where the Forest Service and the BLM are going in and doing actions related to thinnings or timber sale. So we want to, what I call, name the trees, and we're doing that by flying over, and we have a wonderful software program that we have access to. It's a database called Drone Deploy, and you can fly over a whole grid. It could be 100 acres. It will fly and do over 45 minutes and several batteries. It'll take 1,000 pictures, and it seams those pictures together, and then you'll have a 2D or even a 3D map of the area, and then you can correlate that to pictures on the ground. So you can look at an image of a tree from above, and you can click on that, and you can actually go down and see the street view version of what that is. So that's going to be really important for us as an organization to be able to tell the story, and on our personal side, be able to do that as part of the Dreamcatcher restoration project. So stay tuned for that.
Thank you both for joining us for the interview, and thank you, Al, for sharing all of this important information. I'm sorry about your house and land. It's very devastating, and I'm glad Casey brought up how, as a community, we can help you guys, because I was not impacted by the fire, but that area means so much to me, and being able to go out there and help restore it, even though it won't be the same, is it feels like I can do something. So today we cut willow trees, and they will be planted up around Rock Creek on Monday to help restore the habitat and provide protection for fish. So that'll be a really good project.
I've got about 30 or 40 starts of willow. I went along our streams too. We've got a lot of stream work to do along, and when you come up, you'll see that we've got these three tributaries, and on three sides of me, they've clear cut, and so the deer and other animals are kind of and we are my timber up there was I planted it 30 years ago, and it's 20 years ago, pardon me, about 2000. I bought that land after it'd been logged and replanted. And the trees weren't big enough to be considered merchantable, so they're still standing dead. But that the habitat is great. I mean, it's the only habitat a lot of animals have. So, and the deep, steep canyons with these three creeks, and they need some restoration work, and it's really going to benefit the wildlife up there too. So.
Well, I don't mean to drone on and on about drones, but that's another thing that the drones will allow us to do is create a very precise map of your property, where you're doing restoration, where the creeks are, and we can create maps out of that. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And as I mentioned before, it's not only the work. We'll go up there. We're there today and tomorrow and next week. We'll do a lot of hours of work together as a community, of hard labor. But when we're done, we're going to sit around the campfire. We're going to reflect on what we did. We're going to talk about where we're moving forward and what we're doing together. And I think that's an important healing aspect of for all of us, and a lesson that we can apply towards this Archie Creek fire.
That'd be great. And yeah, there's so many people that up there that could use help, but they're and maybe aren't are still really down in the dumps too. So there's a lot of work to be done.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Living Downstream, and thank you for sharing your experiences with the audience.
Well, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Living Downstream.